Dude, your whole page is criticizing a 21-year-old. You need to start becoming original, buddy. He did his videos and moved on. You're obsessing. This is a new channel that started off criticizing a very popular fellow YouTuber that he disagrees with in various areas. Seems like a good move. Might save the criticism for if he's still dwelling on Milo 6 months from now.
Oh, goodbye, my friend. Goodbye.
Well, here we are, the grand finale of my response to Mini Minuteman's response to Graham Hancock's Ancient Apocalypse. And for those of you who have been here for most of the ride, here's a little bit of nostalgia.
Alright, fellas, we finally made it. At long last, we are at Ancient Apocalypse Episode 8, and man, I'm so ready to be done with this.
I, on the other hand, am saddened by this. It's like the end of an era. It's kind of like if we were both graduating from high school and, you know, we're getting ready to leave town because Milo's going to college and I've got a date with the prison warden.
We are going to Dry Falls in the modern state of Washington. It is an enormous, scoured, now dormant waterfall. And now you might be looking at that and thinking, what could possibly make a waterfall that big? Glacial Lake Missoula was enormous. It flooded the space between the Rocky Mountains and the Bitterroot Mountains with as much water as Lake Erie and Lake Ontario combined. Anyway, all of the water of Glacial Lake Missoula was held behind a 2,000-foot-tall ice dam. But being an ice dam on part of a glacier that is slowly receding, it was not exactly a very strong point. And so this ice dam broke, and it released all of that water from Glacial Lake Missoula into the state of Washington through this one pass in the Bitterroot Mountains. As all of that water came cascading through, it created this, the enormous Dry Falls waterfall.
This is all right in my backyard, basically. I mean, the Dry Falls is a couple hours away, and Missoula's not much further in the opposite direction. And yeah, the land around these areas definitely shows signs of extreme flooding. Now, the scientific geological consensus is that there's an ice dam that busted and reformed numerous times, and that's what flooded the area. Randall Carlson has a different take, as we will see as we go forward.
If you look at a map, you can sort of visualize how this would have happened. All of this water coming through that channel, glancing off the mountains, and devastating pretty much everything in central Washington. Now, geologists speculate that this process could have happened upwards of 40 times. But how is that possible? How is it possible for an ice dam to reform? Well, the unique thing about the ice dam at Glacial Lake Missoula is the fact that it was a glacial lobe. This glacial plug was part of the Purcell Trench Lobe, which was a lobe of the Laurentide ice sheet that would stretch down into the Bitterroot Mountains and plug the gap, which is located now near Sandpoint, Idaho.
Now, Sandpoint's a great town. If you're ever up in this neck of the woods, you should absolutely visit that place. It's got this gorgeous ski mountain and this gigantic glacial lake, Lake Ponderay. And yeah, it's definitely been hammered by the floodwaters we're discussing.
So Glacial Lake Missoula would go through this cycle where the Purcell Trench Lobe would push down from the Bitterroot Mountains, block the channel, slowly fill with water, the water would build up too much pressure, the lobe would break off, all that water would drain, which would allow for the lobe to reform and slowly refill with water, etc., etc., until the ice sheet had receded so far back that it was no longer a problem. And it is over this repeated course of draining and refilling that the Dry Falls, well, fall was formed.
Now, this is where Carlson differs from the mainstream. Like I said, they think that it was numerous ice dams, and he thinks that it was one big flood. And honestly, it doesn't really matter a whole lot, in my opinion, as far as like the devastation that was wrought and stuff. I mean, we know a lot of the megafauna died in this time, right in that area. So I mean, unless, you know, this lost civilization, of course, these guys like to think of it as being higher technology than I do. I mean, if it was in that neck of the woods, if it was in the Americas in any way, shape, or form, this could have well been enough to wipe it out, 20 floods or one.
Now, in this episode, we get to talk to Randall Carlson, who's like a pseudo-geologist, I guess. And he tells Graham Hancock that it's not possible that the lake could have refilled that many times and that it must have all drained at once. The evidence he gives for this is he doesn't think it was possible.
Now, Milo's 100% correct here. Carlson doesn't really lay out any sort of a case whatsoever in Ancient Apocalypse. He just basically says, this is what I think. But he does have a YouTube channel, he does speak in public, and he has spoken on Joe Rogan numerous times, and he's laid out some evidence. It's not really that insane sounding. I mean, I'm no geologist, so it's tough for me to evaluate it, because it's really, you're talking massive scales and well outside the realm of my expertise. But like he mentions the tensile strength of ice, he doesn't believe that the ice dam could hold that much water back because of the tensile strength of ice. He doesn't think that the amount of water that would come through and numerous small things could erode the rock as much as we see. He talks about some volcanoes, like a caldera that was filled way up with water to the point where it eroded down the side, which he points out as, you know, having been from a lot of rainfall from all this stuff being knocked, all this ice being knocked up into the atmosphere from the Younger Dryas impact that we'll talk about here in a little bit. My point here isn't to, like, say that Carlson's right and whatever, because, again, I'm outside of my purview, really, but the thing is that he does support his position with evidence outside of Ancient Apocalypse, and that is worth pointing out. He's not just a guy who says, ah, ha, ha, this is what I think.
Now, where is he going with all this? He's using it to support the idea that the Younger Dryas impact happened somewhere on the Laurentide ice sheet, and all of the ice suddenly vaporized, melted, and all drained through the Dry Falls Canyon in Washington State, implying that this enormous waterfall, which is carved into volcanic rock, which is ridiculously hard, happened all at once.
Come on, man. This is the kind of argument that I expect to see when I'm discussing, like, how they carved granite statues in ancient Egypt with copper chisels. This is horseshoe theory incarnate, dude. You're going to tell me next about how the Mohs scale of hardness has granite way up here and water's way down there, and there's no way that water can erode granite? Oh, man. If you guys think those Egyptians and their copper chisels are nuts, you wait till you get a load of these geologists and their water erosion hypothesis. Oh, man.
He talks about the Camas Prairie ripples, which are the remains of a massive eddy that would happen. They're some of the largest ripples on Earth, which is a really cool geologic feature, but isn't proof of one enormous flood.
Well, it may actually be evidence of one giant flood. We should probably compare the hypotheses against each other and what they would predict the size of ripples would be based on their mathematics and whatnot, and see which one would bear this out. Now, I know that Carlson's not a real geologist, so it's, you know, you don't really want to put his evaluation next to a real one, but at the same time, this would go a long way to settling debate, and he's not really positing a bunch of woo, is he? He's not like saying aliens melted the ice caps, or that, you know, the dinosaurs were still around, or that Moses did it. So it's not like this is out of the realm of possibility. So it should probably be something we look into, in all honesty, and I think this would be a simple way to do it. Those ripples should be pretty quantifiable as far as, like, mathematics go. Again, well outside of my purview. I really don't know anything about that stuff.
Hancock goes with Alan West to the black mat layer, which is located in Murray Springs in New Mexico, I think. Now, the black mat layer is, to me, the most convincing piece of evidence that the Younger Dryas impact was actually an impact, and I don't doubt that it was an impact. In fact, I think that there is a lot of evidence that it was. The Chicxulub impact was proven because there was a black mat layer, and so I don't think that it is out of the realm of possibility to say that there was a Younger Dryas impact. Frankly, an analysis of that is a topic for another video.
Now, for those of you who I see in my comment section saying things like, I hate that smug Milo, or he doesn't know anything of what he's talking about, he's just a kid, or wow, Dan, how come he doesn't look more like you? I want you to pay more attention to that last clip that we just saw there. Watch it really close. He's standing against what most mainstream archaeologists would say as far as the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis goes, right? Now, that would mean that he's not a member of the secret archaeological cabal, which means he's not allowed into the Vatican secret archives. He's not allowed into the Smithsonian backrooms where they get chased around by those freaking Nephilim monsters and stuff. None of that is on his table. He's just a regular dude like me that gets on the internet and talks about what he thinks. He just happens to have some archaeology classes under his belt.
Now, the reason I don't go all that much into this episode is because it has almost nothing to do with Graham Hancock's hypothesis. All that he's doing here is trying to talk about the Younger Dryas impact, which, again, I can say without a reasonable doubt did absolutely happen. But I think it's really interesting that he saved his most concrete, actual scientific evidence until the very end of this series.
Now, why is that strange? He's weaving a tale, right? And he's got 8-part series and he saves the big payoff for the end. That makes sense to me. But you guys pay attention there that Milo did say the Younger Dryas impact almost certainly happened, which means those back rooms I was talking about at the Smithsonian, he will never see those.
The only thing that he says in this episode is that the Younger Dryas impact probably happened. And because all of his other theories are predicated on the Younger Dryas impact happening, he just, I guess, supposes that this is enough evidence to be able to make up for the fact that he didn't give us a single piece of evidence in the rest of the episodes.
Hancock's other theories are predicated on some sort of catastrophe. Before it was the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, it was freaking Earth crust displacement, and in between he wasn't really certain what, and if the Younger Dryas impact was completely blown out of the water tomorrow, he would say there was something else, he would find something else most likely. But since there's some science involved around the Younger Dryas impact, some papers published, and some evidence, Well, he's ran with that. Now, how much of that evidence is accurate and how much of it's legitimate? Well, you guys argue about that in the comments down below, but be nice.
So let's start off with material culture, because Graham Hancock spends most of this series talking about material culture. But never once does he actually show us any material evidence of this lost civilization. And now, you could reasonably argue that Graham Hancock does actually show us those things in the form of folklore and storytelling. When I talk about material culture, I'm talking about more than multiple groups of people who all had stories about snakes, because that is not nearly enough evidence to be able to concretely assume a association with two different sites. Now, once we come to the understanding that trying to claim association based purely on folklore in civilizations in different parts of the world is unreliable at best, we have already omitted most of Graham Hancock's evidence for a cultural origin. The fact that multiple groups of people in different parts of the world had stories about serpents or civilizing heroes that came from the sea does not imply that those places were related to one another.
Well, let's be clear. The issue isn't that similar symbolism between cultures means cultural diffusion happened. The issue is the distance between the cultures, and specifically when you put an ocean between them. You know, similar snake motifs between two different cultures that are 1,000 miles apart, that's pretty good evidence that they talk to each other, but you make the Atlantic or the Pacific between those cultures, and all of a sudden, understandably so, most people get a lot more skeptical. Now, I would point out that these myths that are involving this stuff usually involve those seafarer civilizer guys that show up, so it does kind of explain the oceanic separation part away. But that by no means makes it, like, valid for a scientific hypothesis, which Milo's right there. It doesn't mean that it's not accurate, though. So it's like when you get into the realm of, like, armchair speculation, this isn't outside the realm of possibility that some terrible thing happened. Some guys were like, I'm going to make sure we share our knowledge with this next civilization over here, or we're going to set up camp over here and survive and teach the locals this stuff so that we have, like, the trappings of our old life. That's not outside the realm of possibility. Again, you can't really build a hypothesis around that, but it doesn't mean that it's not valid. It's basically the kind of thing that, how far are you willing to accept something in order to speculate on it? Which a lot of what Hancock's work is speculation, right?
The Bimini Road is the only time where Graham Hancock actually speculates to finding the origins of this lost civilization, or truly a piece of material culture left over from them. So, honestly, the episode on Bimini Road is the only episode that actually contains anything that pertains to this entire piece of evidence. But as you'll recall from the lesson on the Bimini Road, the Bimini Road is the only one of these episodes that doesn't actually contain any archaeology in it, because the road is not a road. It is a massive, naturally occurring slab of beach rock.
Yes, Bimini Road is really bad evidence, but it's wrong to say that's the only time that he tries to show us the seat of this ancient civilization. In the first episode, he takes us to Gnong Padang, a 25,000-year-old pyramid, right? Well, if that's the case, that would most likely be much better evidence than the Bimini Road, wouldn't it? So I would point out that that's probably more apt to be the better evidence of the two there, of this seat of this lost civilization. Also, as I mentioned when we talked about Bimini in a previous video, I'm pretty inclined to believe that most likely he even just goes there and talks about it because of the Edgar Cayce Foundation and how much money and power they have in that sphere.
And when you think about that, you come to realize that every single other piece of evidence that Graham Hancock gives is not truly looking for the origins of this lost civilization, but just trying to find evidence of it in written word and similar motifs and things like that.
Why, yes, you could almost say he's looking for fingerprints of the gods and not, like, their buildings.
Graham Hancock says a lot of dates throughout the course of this show. He mentions the dates that archaeologists have obtained from all of these various sites, and of course he also gives his speculative dates for, well, all of these sites. Now, I understand that Graham Hancock's entire theory revolves around the idea that this civilization was wiped out about 12,800 years ago, but he manages to find a way to make almost every single site he talks about somehow fit that narrative.
Hancock only went to sites to support his hypothesis to make his Netflix series with? Well, why didn't he stop all over the place and just talk about every old site? Hell, why didn't he stop at New York City and talk about it too? That would have fit in great with his Netflix series. Gee, I wonder why he only picked sites that lined up with it. Anyway, you know, it is accurate to say that he's not using a lot of the same methods that archaeologists and scientists proper use to date sites. He does use archaeoastronomy, and that's not the best method unless it's really robust. I would say that there's times like what the archaeoastronomy we have at the Hoover Dam is doggone robust. It's pretty hard to pick another date with that, but That's a more modern version of it. But there, you can make, my point is hypothetically, you can find extremely robust archaeoastronomy dating methods. But that's not usually what Hancock wields. Usually he's bringing out something far less than that. But he does try to date the stuff. So you can't really just say he just throws numbers around. He's got a little bit faster and looser means of getting to where he wants to go.
Now, we have covered a lot in talking about Ancient Apocalypse, but all of this means nothing if we don't tie it together. And so the prompt that I want you to be thinking about for your final exam is the implications of the show as a whole. If there were one word that I could use to describe Graham Hancock's Ancient Apocalypse as a whole, it would be the word predatory. Because Graham Hancock's show is designed specifically to take advantage of the most innocent of intent. It capitalizes on curiosity and twists interest into distrust. And throughout its runtime, it does more to sow the seeds of doubt and deceit than provide answers.
Oh boy. Should I be getting a tinfoil hat ready? Because I have a feeling I should be getting a tinfoil hat ready.
Ancient Apocalypse discourages critical thinking. As I mentioned through every single one of the episodes, every single one of the episodes flows about the exact same way. It begins where Graham Hancock will give an impassioned speech about all of those who are trying to silence him. He will then talk about a site where he will imply that there is some great mystery that nobody truly understands, and then he will provide you with his theory as to what happened, and weak though his theories are, he will follow it up with just more vilification of those who disagree with him. And in doing that, he ties a bow on each episode. He makes sure that by the end of it, you subconsciously think that he likes you, as if you agreeing with his ideas will not make you part of that other group that he keeps talking about. And the irony is that in doing that, Graham Hancock does the very thing that he claims to hate so much. He crushes and silences opposing viewpoints and ensures that only one narrative is heard.
That's some convoluted logic right there. Yeah, Hancock vilifies a lot of scientists, but he doesn't do it to silence them. He's happy to debate them publicly, right? All the time. He's perfectly content arguing with people in public forums about this stuff. So silencing them, I don't know about all that. And Ancient Apocalypse is his series, so no matter how unscientific the way he presents it may be, he is entitled to present the stuff as unscientifically as he likes, just as you and I are entitled to argue with each other, Milo, right? But the idea that he's doing all this so that, like, the people that watch it feel like he likes them, and then, like, others, scientists and stuff, man, that's really getting out into the weeds. I'm sorry.
Even in his presentations with archaeologists on the show, we have seen that he has cherry-picked their words. Even in the beginning, he didn't come to them in good faith, not even informing them that he was going to be the interviewer. In cases like Lenny Rijik and Dr. McCafferty and Mark Brink Jr., words were twisted, taken out of context, and used in a way that almost sounds like it supports Graham Hancock's outlandish theories.
Katie Stroud and Dr. McCafferty both expressed frustration with Hancock and the way they were roped into it and or presented. But Mark Briggs Jr., that's not the case. I spoke with him myself on the phone. I'll put a link to the video down below. But when I talked with him, he wouldn't let me record, but he did tell me a lot of what happened. And his impression was that Hancock wasn't the one that did all that. He said that Hancock was really polite. Hancock was really kind, really inquisitive, that he feels like it was the editors that did this crappy job. He feels like it was the editors that put together the whole mess. And that is an important thing to remember here. Hancock is part of a team. Now, he may write the script and stuff, but a lot of that stuff is edited to look a certain way. So when they take and build a case out of those things, this may not well all fall on Hancock's shoulders, but just like Milo's fact checker might not get something right, and Milo's the face of that, I get that Hancock's the face of this, so his boy's doing something wrong. He's going to have to pay for that, too.
And throughout its runtime, it goes from talking about archaeology to the claim that everyone in the world is lying to you.
I knew I should have got that tinfoil hat ready.
That Graham Hancock and a few other brave alternative historians are the only ones who are willing to tell you the truth. I don't think you need me to explain to you why this is so dangerous. I'm sure that anyone who has ever read a history book could easily tell you why the silencing and crushing of opposing viewpoints is a slippery slope, and how the emboldening of only those that agree with you against a unified and common other enemy is something which leads to nothing good.
What? Milo, buddy, you are in the middle of a video where you are calling Hancock's position stupid. You are silencing it by crushing it. Millions of people look to you for answers, and they won't do research on their own for the most part because they will assume that you were doing that properly for them. You are doing exactly what you were accusing Hancock of doing. Should I compare you unfavorably to somebody in history?
And because of this, Graham Hancock's show is designed perfectly to take people who probably didn't really know much about his thoughts in the first place. People who clicked on it because they wanted a cool mystery show about archaeology. People like you and I who are fascinated with history and want to know more about it. But instead of being met with facts and the diverse world of people who lived before us, they are met with what is essentially propaganda.
What the hell, man? Propaganda? Disinformation, sure. But propaganda? That's like Hancock taking a myth of a snake and turning it into Atlantis. You're taking a Netflix series and turning it into the fall of Western civilization.
It contains little to no facts, with the only real archaeological information being the very brief introductions of sites which Hancock gives in the very beginning. And so as the show goes on, the people who clicked on it with the hope of being able to watch a cool thing about archaeology while they're stoned on the couch with their friends are slowly inundated with more and more rhetoric about how there's a whole group of people out there who don't want you to know the truth.
Milo's making more of a conspiracy theory here than Hancock ever does in regards to, like, big archaeology. I mean, he's got Hancock cooking up rhetoric to remove science from its position of authority, and I just see a dude who disagrees with archaeologists about a lot of stuff. I mean, does he say things like the archaeological cabal, blah blah blah, the archaeologists and stop in general, or archaeologists were baffled, archaeologists were forced to accept, even archaeologists accept, archaeologists found and were baffled by. Those are the types of things that he says, right? He always makes archaeologists sound dumb, but he don't make archaeologists sound like evil. I think our boy done jumped the shark here.
Now, it would be inappropriate of me to compare Graham Hancock to any historical figures, but you can look at any point in history, at any point throughout the world, to be able to see people who have used that exact same tactic and achieved things far, far worse.
I'm not saying he's literally Jim Jones, but he's literally Jim Jones.
Now, you're probably thinking, Milo, you're blowing it out of proportion a little bit. It's a show about archaeology. It's really not that serious. And in a way, I would agree with you. It's obviously not as dramatic as some of the implications which I have made. But I want to bring us back to the idea of a slippery slope. Because all it takes is doubt that there is someone out there who's trying to deceive you. All it takes is thinking that there's someone who knows better than everyone else. And before you know it, you wield a lot of power.
Milo was literally describing the position scientists take in regards to Hancock. Hancock's trying to deceive you. Don't let him do that. Trust us. We'll tell you what's right. Now, I don't think that this is some conspiracy on the part of either one of these people, but if Milo wants to hold up this lens and say we're going to look at Hancock through this conspiratorial lens, well, we need to look through that lens both ways, just so we can see how effing absurd it is, because it's pretty absurd.
Now, for someone to not believe in the field of archaeology is fairly inconsequential in the grand scheme of things, but it is a gateway drug into something far more dangerous. We have seen firsthand what a distrust in science can do. My job revolves around analyzing the beliefs of people who claim things like flat earth and chemtrails, things like ancient aliens and Atlanteans. And now those things may seem fairly removed from what matters in your life, and I don't blame you for that. But this distrust goes far deeper than I think we give it credit for. I live in a country where we have lost 1 million people in our most recent pandemic. And while I can't give any quantifiable number, it is humbling to think how many of these lives could have been saved if they hadn't been told to distrust science.
Now, this is conflating things on a level that's really hard to fathom. It was the politicians that people didn't trust. It wasn't the science or the scientists per se. It was the politicians that they felt had corrupted certain scientists. They felt like it was a power grab. We were being stripped of our civil liberties. They were destroying the economy, yada, 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 right? All that stuff has nothing to do with Hancock or pyramids or Atlantis or none of that. But if you're a guy like John Hoops, and your life's goal is to make sure that Graham Hancock doesn't get proper recognition anywhere, we want to constantly combat him. If we could deplatform him entirely, that would be tremendous. Well, you quickly realize nobody gives a shit about people lying about pyramids. They do care if you lie about isms or if you lie about the Rona. So we'll just pin those to Hancock. He was standing somewhere nearby some of those guys at some point in history, so we'll just blame it on him. When in reality, as archaeologists, you guys should understand why people would be leery of science being corrupted by government influences. It's like a serious problem in archaeology's past, right? So, but you can't galvanize the public without those isms, without those Ronas, without those real things that you can attribute to Hancock that he really has nothing to do with.
Once you are able to convince someone that the entire world around them is out to get them, and you are the only one who can tell them the truth, you can tell them anything, and they will listen. It doesn't even matter whether or not you are going to be putting your own life or the lives of those around you in danger. All that matters is that you don't feel like an other.
Now, tribalism's a two-way street. I'm fortunate enough I found a spot between both camps, so I'm happy there, but I watch guys throw rocks back and forth all the time, and they get pretty doggone tribal about it. And from a psychological perspective, there's really not a whole lot of difference between the two camps. They are both very, very tribal. And if you get to like the extremists on both camps, they hate the other guys. Like a lot of places on the internet nowadays, huh?
We live in a time where the line between fact and truth has been blurred to an almost unrecognizable degree, where many are willing to pass off their personal truths as hard facts, where those who seek power, notoriety, money, or fame are willing to say nearly anything if it gets them to the top. And with every misdirection, every lie, and every sown seed of doubt, we are pushed farther and farther away from fact. We are encouraged to no longer believe in the things in the world around us. We are taught that the true greater enemy of humanity is doctors and archaeologists, taught that science is out to get you and that they are all part of some great plot to keep you down. And so people believe it in hopes of finding their truth. But the only truth, as I see it, is looking at the top of that pyramid. Who is the one who benefits the most from speaking like this? Who is the one who benefits the most from spreading lies, deceit, and misconceptions? Who is the one who will objectively reap the greatest profit if they are able to turn the largest amount of people against the rest? I'll give you a hint. It is those who are high enough up that they would have the most to lose if all of us were onto them.
Well, it seems like I've heard this stuff before. That's where. It's a standard conspiracy theorist talking point. Big surprise. Now, Milo talks about the whole slippery slope thing and how an argument can lead somebody's brain into a rabbit hole. And, well, I want to show you what an astrophysicist had happened to her brain when she listened to the arguments that Milo espoused. Not necessarily from him, but the same type of arguments.
And now ancient apocalypse are not big archaeology keeping the truth from us. It's an insidious plot to make white supremacist conspiracy theories consumable to a general audience.
That's not an insidious plot to hide info from you. There's just an insidious plot to hide info from you. Absolutely bonkers.
My point with all of this is that Graham Hancock's show has much broader implications than just what people think about archaeology. It's a way to instill a pariah complex in people, to make them think that the whole world is out to get them. And they channel their distrust and their frustrations at archaeologists, allowing those who are actually responsible for the horrible things in our world to, well, continue doing them. And what do you call it when you have something that is designed specifically to keep people from noticing what's really going on and redirect their frustrations? Propaganda.
Okay, Charlie, tell me more about your mailroom conspiracy. Come on, man. It's one thing to say that Hancock is trying to say that archaeologists are untrustworthy. It's another thing all this together to claim that he's a propaganda spewing machine for the Illuminati or whatever freaking adrenochrome drinking cult you want to posit runs this show here. My God, man. Okay. That's it for this one, and that's it for the series. And, you know, it's like me and Milo will now go our separate ways. And it's sad, but we'll always have 2023 and the good times. And I do honestly want to thank you, Milo, for shouting out my channel in the early days. That was pretty effing awesome of you, man, and that really got me going. And, well, here we are now, so look what you did. Take that. Think twice next time. Honestly, thank you all very much, and have a great evening. We will see you next time.